Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. The top 10 Democratic candidates shared a stage in Houston last night. Some jabbed at their rivals, others pleaded for unity.
For a socialist, you got a lot more confidence in corporate America than I do.
Senator Sanders.
George.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I would just say, hey, Joe, instead of saying no, we can't, let's say yes, we can.
Let's be constitutional.
This is why presidential debates are becoming unwatchable.
Yeah,
this reminds everybody of what they cannot stand about Washington.
President Trump fires his third national security advisor, John Bolton, who texted reporters to say he resigned.
John wasn't in line with what we were doing. And actually, in some cases, he thought it was too tough what we were doing. Mr. Tough Guy.
And the Supreme Court ruled that the Trump administration can bar people from seeking asylum while a legal battle over the southern border continues. Here's NBC's Kristen Welker.
The decision allows the government to deny asylum requests from migrants at the southern border who have traveled through Mexico or another country without seeking protection in that other country first.
Join us. What did you make of the Democratic debate last night? For those of you who find the way you think about the candidates changed, why? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With us from Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, Sungmin Kim. She's White House reporter for The Washington Post and covers the Trump administration through the lens of Capitol Hill. Sungmin, always great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, David.
And with us from Houston, Texas, where he covered the debates, Sahil Kapoor. He's national political reporter for Bloomberg News. Sahil, always a pleasure.
Great to be back, David.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point's own news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Sungmin, and Sahil.
You know, at the top of the hour, I mentioned that this was sort of a debate in which people would have to decide whether to attack Joe Biden. That is, people not named Joe Biden would have to decide whether to attack Joe Biden or Donald Trump. I wanted to play a clip last night. Former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro challenged former Vice President Biden's healthcare stance and then accused Biden of changing his opinion from just moments before.
Barack Obama's vision was not to leave 10 million people uncovered. He wanted every single person in this country covered. My plan would do that. Your plan would not.
They do not have to buy in. They do not have to buy in.
You just said that. You just said that 2 minutes ago. You just said 2 minutes ago that they would have to buy in. You said they would have to buy in.
To buy in. If she qualifies for Medicaid,
are you forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago?
Be in for it.
Are you forgetting already what you said just 2 minutes ago?
Sahil, a number of commentators thought after the debate Castro was going after Biden for his age. What did you make of the substance of what Castro was saying, and what did you make of the slashing approach of it?
There was a lot going on there to unpack. So the first part was there was a competition over who's the rightful heir to President Obama, and this is obviously an issue where Joe Biden is well positioned to make his case and to stake his claim being the vice president. Obviously, here we saw Julian Castro, who also, by the way, served in that administration as a cabinet secretary, arguing that, no, it's him who is actually trying to fulfill President Obama's vision. Now, he did misstate the facts of Biden's plan and what he'd said. Many people would be automatically enrolled. Certain people who are eligible for Medicaid would be automatically enrolled in this public option that Biden was talking about. Castro misstated that a little bit. And then, of course, he was very, very aggressive on Biden. He was the one candidate on stage who clearly came out swinging at Biden. Unlike the previous debate, where there were several others, including Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, who went after the front runner aggressively, and it backfired for them. Voters looked at that. I think Democratic voters looked at that and said they don't want Democrats to be going after each other. They'd like to keep the focus on Trump. And we saw that course shift in a major way from Kamala Harris, at least.
Sungmin, we heard a number of people talk once more about health care last night. Democratic Senator and presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts made her case for Medicare for All during the debate.
So let's be clear. I've actually never met anybody who likes their health insurance company. I've met people who like their doctors. I've met people who like their nurses. I've met people who like their pharmacists. I met people who like their physical therapists. What they want is access to health care. And we just need to be clear about what Medicare for All is all about.
Sungmin, how much do the candidates distinguish themselves in terms of their policy on health care last night in what we heard?
Well, we've seen over the last several debates that healthcare has really been one of the major dividing lines in this Democratic primary field. And while so much of this particular debate was hyped up as this big match between Biden and Warren, it didn't happen all too much except on the issue of healthcare. And I thought the former vice president's line was pretty telling when he said, you know, she's with Bernie, but I'm with Barack, and really defending the Affordable Care Act, which obviously the vice president, former vice president, had a major role in and passing under the Obama administration, and focused on expanding it and strengthening it. And you also saw some of the other candidates try to, get in that Biden lane as well. And I thought Senator Amy Klobuchar had a good night in, especially on the healthcare debate, in pointing out, in kind of, you know, pushing herself into the argument of just pointing out sort of what she felt is kind of the unrealistic part of Medicare for All. But we clearly see that, you know, you have candidates like Senator Sanders, Senator Warren, really trying to be as idealistic and expansive as possible and kind of laying out what they could do and trying to appeal to those that core primary voters. And then you have others like Biden and Klobuchar really trying to be realistic and expanding and building upon what happened with the Affordable Care Act. And that's clearly going to be a continuing dividing line. I'm sure it'll come up in the next debate. And we really won't see where the party is on the, you know, on that healthcare issue until maybe perhaps we have a nominee.
You know, Sungmin, you know, it's an issue that keeps dominating the opening parts of these debates. You know, folks said that they felt as though in some ways Senator Amy Klobuchar came out a little more clearly on the side of the sort of more moderate wing of the party at the moment in terms of how she would expand certain kinds of care. Are we actually learning anything, or are we seeing the candidates kind of rehearse what they've been saying all along?
Well, I think a lot of times we know where the dividing points are. We know the side. We know the camps here of the Democratic field. Who's on the Medicare for All side? Who is on the sort of in the middle? Who's on the side of expanding and protecting Obamacare? And who's also kind of in the middle, which is middle of those two positions, which is where Pete Buttigieg has actually tried to be. But we're not learning much more at this point. But again, this debate is going to be about contrast. So you're going to continue to hear questions being posed about where on healthcare, on immigration, where there has been these clear divisive points within the Democratic primary field.
Jack Beatty, I want to play a clip for you that seemed in some ways for folks who are fighting old wars, rhetoric and real and yet meaningful. You know, two of the senior figures on the stage dip back 17 years to the Senate debate ahead of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. Former Vice President Biden was in the U.S. Senate at the time. Last night he said, quote, he never should have voted to give Bush, meaning President Bush, the authority to go in and do what he said he was going to do. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders offered this response.
You talked about the big mistake in Iraq and the surge. The truth is, the big mistake, the huge mistake, and one of the big differences between you and me, I never believed what Cheney and Bush said about Iraq. You voted against the war in Iraq and helped lead the opposition.
Jack Beatty, how meaningful is that issue and that exchange last night?
I don't think it's so meaningful this time round. It was decisive, I think, in 2008 for Barack Obama as against Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton. His bona fides on being against the war, admittedly as a state senator, were clear, whereas Hillary and Biden had voted for it. But I think that's yesterday's issue. More like today's issue is Afghanistan, where the vice president said, I was against the surge in Afghanistan, distinguishing himself from his principal, President Obama, and showing the tendency that Secretary Castro noted, that of being with Obama when it's in his advantage politically and being against him when it seems to be against current Democratic orthodoxy on Afghanistan. So in general, the discussion of foreign affairs was, to call it shallow, is I think, an overstatement.
Jack, why do you think that is?
Well, because I think, for example, look at Elizabeth Warren. She knows that she knows the situation of women in Afghanistan. She knows that if the Taliban take over, girls will be taken out of school. They'll be back to the medievalism of treating women there. They're almost there now under an elected government. And yet, when talking about Afghanistan, she said, "Oh, we got to get all those troops out of there, and somehow peace will prevail, and somehow the reason will show." In other words, she didn't even surface the humanitarian worry about what seems to be one of the real gains of American intervention there, namely that half the population of Afghanistan at least has a better chance at life than they did before. She didn't even admit the argument and went right for the sort of Democratic base feeling of get them out of there tomorrow.
And Sahil, before we take our first break, what was a standout moment or a surprise to you? What candidate managed to do something that you didn't expect?
That's a great question, and I'm not sure there was that moment. I don't think there is anything major that happened in the debate that will change the shape of the race, and that was kind of the takeaway to me. I mean, Biden has been the front runner steadily ever since he announced. Nothing seems to rattle his poll numbers. Constant gaffes, constant unforced errors haven't stopped him. His 76 years of age in a party that's becoming younger and more diverse and more female, that hasn't stopped him. His ideological distance from, you know, the passions of the party base hasn't stopped him. His checkered history on race hasn't sunk him. Nothing seems to work on him. So I didn't see anything last night that'll change that dynamic of the race, where Biden is in the lead, Warren is steadily rising, Bernie is pretty much constant, and Harris is struggling to get her foothold again.
As you can hear, we're talking about Democratic debates. We're going to take a whole welter of calls when we come back from just this brief break. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about how Democratic candidates fared in last night's debate and major moves in the Trump administration on environmental regulations and immigration. You can join our conversation. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm going to reintroduce our great panel of guests with me this week in a moment. But first, the calls are coming in. They're pouring in. They're coursing in. And we're going to take them. Let's first go to Yellow Springs, Ohio. John, thanks for calling. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, hey there. I thought there were a lot of good performances last night. Cory Booker was looking strong. I really, after last night, have settled on Liz Warren and Kamala Harris as VP. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the one guy who should be kicked off Democrat Island is Julian Castro. The way he tried to old shame Joe Biden last night. That's mean. You know,
John, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going
to
say,
you wouldn't talk to your. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, you said you want Julian Castro thrown off the Democrat island, as you put it, for shaming Joe Biden for his age. You also mentioned that Elizabeth Warren got your vote. One or two sentences, what turned you in her direction?
She's so clear because, I'm college educated and have a master's degree and everything, and I've thought about these issues. And, you know, it's so complicated to be president. There's so many things you have to know. And she is so clear. And I guess it comes down really to, like, the fact that corporate money and special interests just really dictate policy, you know?
Okay.
That's why we can't really do anything. Like,
well,
that's way
thank you. Thank you for listening, and thank you for sharing on that. I'm going to move on because we've got a bunch of people we want to get on here. Let's go to Madison, Wisconsin. Ron, thanks for listening. Tell us your thoughts about last night's debate.
Yes, hi. I'm a lifelong Republican. I'm 72 years old. Been studying politics for a long time. I am not a Trumpian. I saw a lot of people who had some good points last night, except for Bernie Sanders and Senator Warren. It's nice to be able to identify the issues, but to have correct solutions is something else. I'm looking for a more moderate person. I'm kind of watching the senator from Minnesota, Castro, except for his ridiculous attack on Biden, who I'm not impressed with, by the way, never have been. He has some good points, too.
All right.
The thing is, I'm hoping that the Democrats would do the smart thing and head more towards the middle than towards the left. The left, as far as I'm concerned, it's just as bad for the country as the Republicans' far right.
Well, thank you for that, Ron. Appreciate it. A sort of a Klobuchar curious voter there from Madison, Wisconsin, on the Republican side, looking for a more moderate vote. We also have a call from Diamond Head, Mississippi. Thanks for calling in, Nate, and thanks for being a listener.
Hi. I was singularly disappointed in the Democratic debate and in the Democratic presidential race in general because I think the single most important issue is the survival of democracy and freedom in America, and I think this election is about the soul of America. And David Brooks nailed this down several weeks ago, talking about the Democratic debates. I wish David Brooks was running. We need a vision, and we need leadership. These people are proposing to be our leader. Give us some vision, folks. Fight for America.
Well, I hope the campaigns are listening as well. Thank you for that, Nate. Want to take another call also from Lexington, Kentucky, the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Forrest, thanks for calling in. What were your thoughts on all this?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I never thought I would become a single-issue voter, but the kids in cages, man, I just can't get over it on the border, and I'm looking for somebody to figure out or come up with a plan of, you know, how to keep the families together and fast track them back to Central America or Mexico or whatever. I can't even believe that I'm having this conversation and how that issue has just kind of fallen off the table, the psyche of America. And finally, I think they haven't told the narrative yet of most of these families. Children that are coming up here, they're Catholics or Protestant. I mean, they're on the same page with us as far as, you know, if you say we have a, I don't buy it, but they say, we have a Christian as our national, religion, man, get on board. Let's figure out how to get kids out of cages. And I didn't hear anything about that.
Well, thank you for calling on that, Forrest. I'll take one last call and pop over to our panel then. This call from Columbia, South Carolina. Joseph, you're on the air. Thank you for calling in, sir.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So
my issue is not with the debates last night, but with the issue of the primary concern being Trump. Although that is an important concern, I think the people are not united in that endeavor. The Democratic Party certainly is, but the majority of the population is not the Democratic Party. It's independent. And there's only one candidate to me who's actually trying to unite the country. And all these policies that all these candidates are talking about on the debate stage, they can't do anything without Congress. And you can't get Congress without uniting them. So you can't enact Medicare for All without Congress. The executive acts or executive authority, it ends when your presidency ends. So that being said, I think the debate missed Tulsi Gabbard last night. The second debate did show that debates can change the electoral, the process, because Kamala Harris has not recovered from the second debate, and I don't see her recovering.
Thanks so much for your call. And for our South Carolina listeners in the Palmetto State, my colleague and co-host Meghna Chakrabarty, she'll be in Columbia, South Carolina next month, and we'll be recording a show there on October 3rd. I now want to reintroduce the guests who've been being with us this whole hour to talk about the week in politics. Sungmin Kim is White House reporter for The Washington Post. Sahil Kapoor is a national political reporter for Bloomberg News. And of course, we have, as ever, our own news analyst here at On Point, Jack Beatty. Sahil, you were there in Houston last night. I want to play a clip from what viewers saw. There was a point at which the home state former congressman, Democrat Beto O'Rourke, gave an impassioned moment, arguably the debate's boldest answer, about gun control.
And in Odessa, I met the mother of a 15-year-old girl who was shot by an AR-15. Mm-hmm. And that mother watched her bleed to death over the course of an hour because so many other people were shot by that AR-15 in Odessa and Midland. There weren't enough ambulances to get to them in time. Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. We're not going to allow it to be used against our fellow Americans anymore.
Sahil Kapoor, what did you make of that moment?
Beto O'Rourke came out very energetic, much more aggressive this time. I think he had a lackluster first two debates, so the bar wasn't particularly high for him. And he has taken up this cause passionately after we bookended essentially the month of August with two horrific shootings, one of them in his hometown and another one in his home state of Texas. Mm-hmm. And he has taken up the cause of confiscation of military-style assault weapons with compensation for the people who have them. And this is an issue that Democratic voters largely agree with him on. The country is very, very divided. There's a passionate set of people on the other side who say no chance they're going to give up the their guns. But this is a cause that is top of mind for Democrats, the issue of gun control. And O'Rourke kind of made his mark on that. Now, your callers also hinted at the biggest questions within the Democratic Party in terms of where they land on ideology, whether it's going to be a more progressive approach, a more moderate approach, or whether it's going to be this idea of restoring America to what it was before President Trump, which is essentially what Joe Biden is running on, or flipping the table and creating a whole new kind of political and economic system, which is what Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are talking about.
I want to dart in here and take a question quickly from Princeton, Massachusetts. I believe Debbie has a call about Beto O'Rourke. Debbie, what did you make of what the former congressman had to say last night?
Hi, I loved what he had to say. That got me out of my chair. I thought it was fabulous, and I think that's what the country needs to hear. And that's what's going to get the young people and the people who voted Obama back to the polls and voting for someone who's going to make a difference. Now, I'd like to see him team up with Elizabeth Warren, frankly. I don't know what the best combo is yet, but you commented earlier in the program that you didn't see anything unusual or surprising. I thought what he had to say was very exciting, and I'm really thrilled to see that coming forward, and I'm definitely going to get behind him.
Thanks, Debbie. Sahil, I did want to ask you one question. You know, there are some people who looked at John Hickenlooper, who finally retreated from the field as he was in the low single digits at best and is running for Senate in Colorado. There are some people expecting that to happen for O'Rourke in Texas, that he, you know, really had a good run against Ted Cruz, even though he fell short in a red state, and might be able to recapture that, given that he hasn't been able to catch fire in this debate. It seems to me as though, I don't know what the heck, but, you know, it seems to me as though he's staked out a pretty strong position that a lot of people in Texas might not embrace if he were to try to do that.
He absolutely has. He has ruled it out emphatically. He said he's not going to run for Senate again. Of course, that's not going to stop Democrats from continuing to call on him to do just that. He has a filing deadline of December or so. So, you know, he can always change his mind. He would not be the first presidential candidate to change his mind and turn tail and run for Senate after saying he wouldn't. Apart from him, there's also Steve Bullock of Montana, who Democrats believe would be their strongest bet to flip that a Republican seat in a red state where he's proven he can win statewide. He also has expressed no interest in running for Senate. So it's not clear that the Democrats are going to, you know, lose some of their presidential candidates to the Senate level, even if some voters would like to see that.
Now, this wasn't the only candidate to address gun violence. When the topic came up in last night's debate, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker said the nation needs to be more active on gun control. And he said the nation needs not to wait for it to become a personal issue.
This is a crisis of empathy in our nation. We are never going to solve this crisis if we have to wait for it to personally affect us or our neighborhood or our community before we demand action. You want to know how we get this done? We get this done by having a more courageous empathy where people don't wait for this hell to visit upon their communities.
Now, Jack Beatty, I got to say, I thought this was actually a pretty compelling and moving moment. Cory Booker, on the other hand, I've seen a number of female commentators on Twitter and social media say Cory Booker is being praised for something that, you know, Marianne Williamson was not earlier on. What distinguishes what he had to say from the kinds of things that she said about the role of empathy in public life?
I'm trying to recall what she said about it. Basically, she seemed to say the world needs love and I'll offer it. Or that was my general impression of her, of what she was saying. Courageous empathy is a laudable sentiment. And I think he was aiming somewhat there to undercut the Whitman-esque authenticity of Beto O'Rourke, who was sort of drenched in the blood of El Paso, and who, you know, with Whitman could say, I am the man, I suffered, I was there. And I think he was saying, well, we've got to have some imagination here and some empathy. I appreciate what people say about Cory Booker. He is a very attractive human being. He's charismatic. And yet there is an evasiveness, at least I find, and a loftiness about his rhetoric that just I sort of lose it at it's aspiring toward the higher guff. You know what I mean? You just somehow don't know what he's saying, and it's as if he dissolves the real tough-minded political issues into lofty sentiments where we can all get together and have empathy. Well, that's great, but I don't see. In other words, I understand. I think why he sunk so low in the polls.
Mm-hmm. We've got some commentators talking about these issues in a related sphere. Ed Koyeski, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, Ed, posts on Facebook, love to see 1,000 CEOs send letters to senators urging gun control, maybe 10,000 of them. Not sure what the cut line is for senators to believe that 90% of Americans want more gun controls in place now. And Andrew Ross Sorkin of the New York Times wrote recently of an initiative taken up, I believe, by the CEO of Levi Strauss to get other CEOs to call with him for certain kinds of background checks, other role on legislation and executive orders on gun control, and that actually is received some success with that, got more than 100 to join him on that. Richard Michaels posts on Facebook, how many of those CEOs will back up their request by not supporting the senators financially? Sung Min, I wanted to ask you about what's going on in Congress. Where do things stand in terms of the desire, particularly from Democrats, to address the question of gun violence in the country?
Well, as Democrats try to ramp up the pressure on Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to take up some gun restrictions, Republicans and several Democrats are really largely waiting on President Trump, because we know that unless the president gets behind some sort of gun restrictions, some sort of gun legislation, there's no chance that anything advances Capitol Hill. And there are pretty low prospects in Congress for gun legislation to begin with. So the president did have a meeting yesterday. He told reporters out before he left for Baltimore that he had a good meeting. There doesn't seem to be a clear, conclusive result as of yet. And we're still asking the questions. But right now, the president, every time there has been a major gun tragedy and the focus in Congress turns to what sort of legislation that Washington do to try to stem gun violence, it's just the president has, you know, put forward some things and then walk them back, particularly once the influence of the NRA gets in his ear. We saw that after the Parkland shootings in February 2018. We're seeing that again after the El Paso and Dayton shootings. There is some interesting movement, I will point out, on Capitol Hill among Republicans. So a bunch of reporters sat down earlier this week with Senator Pat Toomey. We know he is one of the chief authors of the background checks legislation that that failed to advance in the Senate in 2013 after the Sandy Hook shootings at in Newtown, Connecticut. And he told us that several Republicans who did not support his legislation back in 2013 were actually rethinking it. And, you know, they're not supportive just yet. But after everything that's happened, they are open to at least considering it again. And we found out yesterday that one of those senators is Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who is a very close Trump ally. He's a chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee that has jurisdiction over gun legislation. And he told us that particularly after the shootings in Odessa, Texas, where a more fulsome background check system could have actually been able to flag the shooter in that case, he really was rethinking his position. He's working with Senators Toomey and Manchin on perhaps changing the legislation. But again, bottom line, expanded background checks could not pass a Democratic-led Senate in 2013. So I am very skeptical that that would pass a Republican Senate in 2019.
It's a fair point. There's Sungmin Kim on state of gun control in the United States Congress, who we're going to be discussing a lot more in the segment to come. The firing of National Security Advisor John Bolton, asylum claims at the border, new impeachment guidelines from House Democrats, all that and more. Join our conversation. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. In other news this week, the Trump administration moved to ban flavored e-cigarettes, that is, to ban the flavored packets for vaping, which is believed to be more alluring for teens. The EPA announced a repeal of Obama-era clean water protections. And in North Carolina, Republican Dan Bishop won a victory over his moderate Democratic challenger. That's good news for the GOP, but tempered by the fact it was a razor-thin win in a district that President Trump carried by nearly 12 points in 2016. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm joined by a terrific panel of guests this hour. Sungmin Kim is a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Sahil Kapoor is national political reporter for Bloomberg News. And we, of course, we're joined by our own news analyst here at On Point, Jack Beatty. Jack, I want to play a clip today. On Tuesday, President Trump announced on Twitter that John Bolton would no longer serve as his administration's national security advisor. The president discussed Bolton's departure with the press on Wednesday in the White House.
Frankly, he wanted to do things not necessarily tougher than me. You know, John's known as a tough guy. He's so tough he got us into Iraq. That's tough. And but he's somebody that I actually had a very good relationship with, but he wasn't getting along with people in the administration that I consider very important.
Now, Jack, obviously in this administration, National Security Advisor has the job security of the drummer in Spinal Tap. By the same token, you know, from your reading, do you take this to be about whether or not he has a good relationship, or do you take this to be about the direction of foreign policy and national security in this administration?
Well, I think it was a combination of both, wasn't it? The Financial Times reports, I hadn't seen this elsewhere, that in something to do with sanctions on China, the Bolton deliberately misrepresented to the Secretary of Treasury what the president wanted to do. And then the president had to call back on a tweet the measure. It was a sanction against Chinese companies. In other words, he acted duplicitously toward his own boss to advance his own agenda, which is to be hardline on everything under the sun. So it seems to me that the friends of sanity everywhere can welcome his departure from the administration. And I can certainly understand why Trump would want to get rid of a man who just, in fact, in this case, and I think probably in others, misrepresented what the president wanted in order to advance Bolton's own policy agenda.
Sung Min, you cover the White House. Let's talk a little bit about what we learned about the White House's inclination to invite Taliban leaders in to Camp David for what seemingly was to be the end game of negotiating some sort of peace there.
So I think, I mean, clearly that was one of the final, that seemed to be the final straw that ousted, that got John Bolton ousted. It was a surprise moment. It was finishing up. I actually had pool duty earlier that day out while the president was golfing at his golf course in Northern Virginia. And this came, we knew that there had been negotiations ongoing, that there had been a deal in principle. But then the president, you know, surprised us all on Saturday night by announcing that he had the secret meeting planned at Camp David with the leaders of the Taliban, but it had been called off because of the attacks that had killed an American soldier a couple days prior in Kabul. But I think that, I mean, the clashes between Bolton and sort of his worldview and what the president had looks at the world had been ongoing for a very long time, clearly. I mean, we at the Washington Post had written extensively about how the president had been irritated with Bolton's kind of counsel and strategy when it comes to Venezuela. Clearly, there were clashes on Afghanistan. You know, when I was traveling with the president in Korea earlier, a few months ago, on that major day when the president was headed towards the DMZ to meet with Kim Jong-un, Bolton wasn't there with him. He was actually on his way to Mongolia on a pre-scheduled trip, and I think we had seen signs of some time of just that distance between Bolton and the president. And I think that it finally kind of came to a head. This was something that we had seen coming for some time, maybe not in the fashion that happened on Tuesday, but it really and also just as a staffing note with this White House. Your time is very limited and can really your fortunes can also just kind of turn on a dime at any given day.
And Sung Min, about the substance of the Afghan negotiations, like what does it say about, let's just focus on the president because the administration seems to be conflicted within itself on almost every one of these issues, right? But in terms of the president himself, what does he want to achieve there? What does he want America's role to be there?
Well, the president has talked for some time. He is not, by in his nature, a hawkish person. He talked about he has wanted to withdraw. He had talked about this before the campaign, and also on a related note, I mean, this is a president who just. I mean, we know Trump is a guy who fundamentally likes deals, and he does want some sort of a major foreign policy deal, which is something that he has not had in his presidency so far. When we're looking, I mean. That is part of motivation for all his dealings with Kim Jong-un in North Korea. Clearly, he was pursuing one in Afghanistan. Conflicts within his own administration, within his advisors on what he should do, which is what we saw kind of come to a head with Bolton's ouster earlier this week.
And Jack Beatty, briefly, what do you think about what we've learned about where this president is? You know, he's sort of hawkish in the streets, you know, a bit more dovish in the Oval. But what coherent can you pull out of what we've learned about his approach to all this?
I think we've learned that the president is willing to do almost anything to advance his own political interest. The New York Times reports that the deal collapsed, the deal with the Taliban, because the president wanted to be the deal maker who put the final parts together himself. So now we go back to war full time with the Taliban. The president was bragging about that, and the deal broke down because the president, it seemed, rushed the whole pace of things. There had been no agreement with the Taliban. They said they would not come here until there was an agreement. They didn't want to come at the same time as the Afghan president. Nevertheless, the president forced the issue, and the talks with the Taliban going on a year collapsed. And why did he do that? Because when he goes to Camp David, he sees those photographs of Jimmy Carter, Sadat, and Begin in 1978 in Carter's heroic and singular achievement, the accords between Egypt and Israel, and he wants that kind of achievement. He wanted to stand before the country and say, look, I've done it. And because of that motive, the deal seems to have fallen through, at least temporarily, and we're back to war in Afghanistan.
Sahil, this week there was a major ruling. It was a stay rather than a final decision, but by the U.S. Supreme Court that basically temporarily upholds the Trump administration's policy on people seeking asylum who've come to our southern border, particularly from Central America through Mexico. Ken Cuccinelli, he's the acting U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Director, spoke to my colleague Rachel Martin of NPR's Morning Edition yesterday about the ruling. Cuccinelli explained what would happen if the Trump administration ultimately wins the case.
This will give us the ability to, first of all, deter some people coming with asylum claims, which is part of the intention.
Okay.
And second, it will allow asylum officers who would be otherwise occupied dealing with what I'll call the short-term jobs at the border, like credible fear interviews, like reasonable fear interviews, all the things that asylum officers have to do on a short turnaround that take priority over getting to the asylum case backlog.
Sahil Kapoor, how significant a ruling is this, and how significant a policy would this be if it's ultimately upheld by the courts?
It's a significant ruling, no doubt. I think it signals, along with previous Supreme Court decisions, most notably the travel ban from a series of majority Muslim countries, that the Supreme Court is willing to give the Trump administration a lot of deference on the issue of immigration, which, by the way, tends to be the case. You know, administrations have a lot of leeway in terms of how to enforce immigration laws. And one thing we've seen from this administration is a very dogged determination to use their executive authority to, you know, raise the bar, to make it harder for people to come here legally, not just illegally. There's a lot of talk about illegal immigration, and that's certainly part of what the administration is trying to do. But the underappreciated part of it is how hard they're working to, you know, to make it harder for people who are trying to come here legally through asylum claims and, you know, even on work visas and things like that. So it seems that the Supreme Court is willing to greenlight this at this point. If you look at where the Supreme Court has been in the past, you probably would be optimistic of being the administration at this point. You know, this 5-4 conservative majority on the court is a big, big deal. And it looks like that's going to be entrenched for a long time. I think that's going to be President Trump's probably his biggest legacy that'll last long after he's left office.
I want to take a call now from Clearwater, Florida. Tony is on the air. Tony, thanks for listening. What are your thoughts on all this?
Hi. Well, I'm the son of immigrants. We came over legally. We don't have a lot of tolerance for illegal immigrants because of that. I have many friends in the Southwest. One of the main motivations why these Mexicans are coming over with tunnels and over the fence is because if the lady is pregnant and she has the child in Texas or New Mexico, that child automatically becomes an American citizen. It's a totally ridiculous situation. That's why they're coming in. Once that child is born, they get all the benefits of being an American. It shouldn't be that way. If they
just
come in illegally,
Tony, let me just ask a quick question. I guess it sounds like your parents, after you were born, it sounds like, or your parents came to this country.
I was born on Ellis Island.
You were born on
Ellis Island. I was born on Ellis Island.
So it sounds like
my mother.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like your parents wanted that for you as well. Tell me the distinction you see between the aspirations of your parents for you and your family, and those you see of people who come to this family who say to this country who say that they're fleeing physical threats or political persecution.
Very easily. My parents did it all legally. They waited 2 years. They had no money. They were escaping a terrible situation in Europe. but they came legally. My father said, we won't do anything illegal. His feelings were, if you come to this country illegal, what kind of person are you? He waited for 2 years. He did all the papers. They came. They did what they had to do.
Somebody climbing over a fence and
breaking the law is not a good citizen.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts, Tony. I appreciate it. Jack Beattie, I also wanted to turn the question of immigration, of who's welcome here. There were questions arose in sort of frantic and perilous circumstances for Bahamians who were trying to escape the effects of and the onslaught of Hurricane Dorian. There seemed to be some confusion on ferries that were going to take people to American land to try to get them out of the way. And ultimately, I think that the ruling was if people didn't have formal visas allowing them to come to this country, that they would not be allowed here during the storm. What do you make of that policy and of that development?
What a grotesque absurdity. I mean, the idea that people in the middle of their roofs flying off, the flood, the water's drenching down, they're going to take their passports in order to get safe passage to the United States. The president came out and said, oh, well, you know, it's known the Bahamas are a hotbed of drug dealers and bad people and so on. And we all know that if, let's face it, that the people who lived in the Bahamas were Norwegian somehow or emigrated from Denmark, he would have welcomed them in a moment. This is another example of the racially charged immigration policy of this administration. And it's shameful when you think of just how desperately needy these people are to demand that they, you know, show their credentials when everything they own, including the credentials, has been washed away.
The outrage you're hearing from Jack is mirrored in some ways on Capitol Hill on a series of legal questions and challenges to the president. The Democratic-led House Judiciary Committee formally voted for the first time to investigate whether articles of impeachment are warranted against President Trump. The committee's chairman, Jerry Nadler of New York, set out the rules governing the inquiry in a press conference yesterday.
With these new procedures, we will begin next week an aggressive series of hearings investigating allegations of corruption, obstruction, and abuse of power against the president.
And yet, Sungmin Kim, this isn't a banner headline. This isn't, you know, five columns dominating the front pages of the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. The Times said it's sort of inching towards impeachment hearing. What's the import of this?
Well, they are inching towards impeachment a little bit. But the bottom line is the House Democrats are incredibly still conflicted about how to proceed, if to proceed, on impeachment proceedings against the president, because you have a growing number, a growing number of Democratic lawmakers who say you need to pursue these proceedings. Jerry Nadler and his committee are definitely that committee is stacked with progressives, people who have been more aggressively outspoken against the president and want to pursue impeachment. And I would imagine that if Nadler didn't have Speaker Pelosi hanging over him, that he probably would have already done this by now. But the most important person here is Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And we know that this is something that she does not want to do. She knows the potential backlash that an impeachment, that impeaching the president could have on potentially her House majority. What Pelosi's political imperative here is protecting those members who flipped Republican held seats to Democratic hands and won the House majority back for Democrats. And a lot of those members do not want, do not want to pursue these impeachment proceedings. And there was an op-ed from one of those members precisely this morning. Congressman Max Rose represents New York. He is clearly one of the major targets for House Republicans in their efforts to regain the House majority. And he laid out several reasons why he does not want to pursue impeachment proceedings, chief among them that it will really tear this country apart.
It sounds like the Democrats trying to oh so gingerly wield a sledgehammer and trying to figure out how to do that. We've been hearing there from Sungmin Kim. She's White House reporter for The Washington Post. Sungmin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've also had Sahil Kapoor. He's the national political reporter for Bloomberg News. Sahil, always a pleasure.
Thank you, David.
And On Point's own news analyst, Jack Beattie. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you, David.
Our executive producer here at On Point is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.